The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Rise and Fall of English Jewry, is dedicated to the merit and honor of Rav Reuven ben HaRav Dov Ber, Mr. Reuven Moskowitz.
If we would make a graph detailing the conditions of Ashkenazic Jewry during the Middle Ages, starting from the year 476, the date often given by authorities for the fall of the Roman Empire and beginning of the Middle Ages, the first 500-some years would witness very little change in our graph. True, Ashkenazic Jewry produced a few noteworthy scholars, such as Rabbeinu Shimon of Mans, France, and the author of the Azhora, the liturgical poem Ato Enchalta, describing the Taryag Mitzvahs, that at one time was widely recited on Shavuos throughout the world. There was also Rav Moshe ben Klonimos, the scholar who was asked to come to the community of Mainz, Germany, from Lucca, Italy, by the King Charles the Simple of France. There was also Rav Moshe's son, Klonimos, the father of Rabbeinu Meshulam, as well as Rabbeinu Ovon of Mainz, France, who also migrated to Mainz, Germany. But these were notable exceptions in what seemed to be a sea of scholarly mediocrity. As we've already described in previous lectures, the next 300 years saw a steep and unprecedented rise in scholarship, beginning with the Chachmei Lotar, the scholars of the Rhine Valley, Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Shimon HaGadol, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, and their disciples, Rabbeinu Yitzchak ben Yehuda, Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Yochor, Rabbeinu Yitzchak HaLevi, and beyond to Rashi and the Bali Tosfos. This great era in France and Germany came to an abrupt end with the death of Rabbeinu Meir of Rothenburg and the Rindfleisch massacres at the end of the 13th century. From a point of scholarship, the next 200 years, this would be the 1300s and 1400s, despite the presence of scholars of note such as the Ma'aril and the Trumas HaDeshen, subjects of a coming lecture, this was a relative dark age. In other words, the graph we'd be making would look like a bell curve with little activity at both ends. The first 500 some years would be almost no activity, then from 476, the beginning of the Middle Ages. Then there would be a very steep, precipitous rise. The Bali Tosfos, the Rabbeinu Gershom, then it would just immediately fall down. Again, there would be scholars, not of the same level, same either quality or quantity. Similarly, although there would be some distinctions, a graph detailing the economic well-being of Ashkenazic Jewry during the same period will look essentially the same. In other words, increased and profitable economic activity went hand in hand with immigration and growth in population, increased deployment of resources towards education and the patronage of scholars, and the appearance of Gedolei Torah, giants of Torah scholarship. Probably a graph of American Jewry would look much the same as the first half of this medieval graph. A period of relative inactivity, followed by an impressive pattern of growth. In all probability, of all the countries of Ashkenazic Jewry, no country's growth and decline follows such a characteristic curve, has left so much of its economic and political records intact, and lends itself to careful examination, is that of England. A relative newcomer as a center of Ashkenazic Jewry, England has the distinction of having set the precedent of how medieval Christendom treated its jury. It was the scene of the first blood libel. It was also the most zealous of all the countries of Europe in imposing the anti-Jewish strictures of the church. In addition, England created the most narrow and confining economic base of any of Europe's juries, held the Jews as chattel and virtual captives, and was the first country that its official policy plundered its Jews and reduced them to a state of abject poverty. By the way, it was also the first major country to expel its Jews. Reminds me of a quote made by Krishna Menon, India's chief delegate to the United Nations from 1952 to 62. I quote, "The reason that the sun never sets on the British Empire is because God doesn't trust the English in the dark." The precipitous rise of English Jewry and its dramatic fall is the subject of this lecture. To begin with, one cannot separate the history of England's Jews from the history of its kings and wars. Allow me, therefore, to preface this lecture with a condensed history of England from Roman times to the Norman invasion in 1066 in the early years of the Norman monarchy. The island of Britain was originally occupied by a people known as the Celts or Celts. The Boston Celtics are named after these people. The Irish of Boston are Celts. To this day, the countries of Ireland and Scotland and the area of Wales and Cornwall in western England and Brittany in northern western France are made up largely of descendants of these Celts. The name of Britain comes from the Celtic tribe of the Bretons, many of whom fled England approximately year 500 to northwest France and settled in the area that is today called Brittany. The name Scotland comes from a Celtic tribe, which its origin actually was from Ireland, and these were the Scotti, who settled western Scotland approximately during that time in the 6th century. In the year 43 of the Common Era, the Romans conquered England from the Celts. It was at that time they built a city on the River Thames and called it Londinium. Today we call it London. Although the Romans abandoned England as the Roman Empire was in the process of dissolution, approximately year 400, they left behind many rich archaeological remains, such as the Roman road system that converges on London, and Hadrian's Wall in northern England. It was designed to keep out the raiding Celts from Scotland. The wall was built by the Emperor Hadrian starting in the year 121 or 122 and crossed northern England at its narrowest point between the River Tyne on the east, right near Gateshead, and Solway Firth or estuary on the west, 73.5 miles away. Substantial sections of Hadrian's Wall still stands. The Romans also left Britain with a Christian church that survived and flourished even after the Roman withdrawal. But another conquering force took over England not long after the Romans left. These were the Germans. Even before the Roman withdrawal, Germanic peoples from across the English Channel North Sea had already begun immigrating to England. I mean, the Romans were fighting them off. But it was in the 100 years between 450 and 550 that the Germanic tribes of the Angles and the Saxons managed to conquer virtually all of England and push the native Britons into the area in western England called Wales, thus fragmenting the Celtic peoples who are now concentrated in the area of Wales as well as Scotland and Ireland. During the years of conquest, these Germans, however, often met stiff resistance from the Celtic chieftains. One of them defeated the Germans in the year 516 in the celebrated Battle of Badon. According to one historic record, the Annales Cambria, the name of the Celtic chieftain who defeated the Anglo-Saxons was Arthur. This historic warrior was the inspiration for the legend of Camelot, King Arthur, Queen Guinevere, Lancelot, Galahad, and the other knights of the Round Table. Eventually, the Germans totally crushed the Celtic resistance, took over the country, and gave it its name, England. England, or the land of the Angles, the name of one of the chief Germanic tribes. The Anglo-Saxons also laid the foundation for local English government by dividing the country into sections called hundreds and boroughs. The term hundreds originated from German military units, 100 soldiers. Eventually meant a tract of land occupied by a large group of peasants. Boroughs, as in borough park, originated from the German burg or city, which were originally fortresses for protection. So you had the tracts of land, the hundreds, and you had the fortresses or the burgs. The semi-autonomous sections had their own courts and were administered by officials called reeves. The hundreds and boroughs were in turn grouped together into a large section called shires. These shires were later called counties. The reeves, or officials of the shires, were called shire reeves, or a term we're all familiar, sheriffs. So the sheriff of Nottingham was the reeve, the highest official of the shire of Nottingham. I'm not going to speak about Friar Tuck. This system continued on into the modern age. From the mid-800s on, England was repeatedly raided by the Vikings from Denmark and Norway. The Danes eventually conquered East England in an area that became known as Danelaw. They were resisted by the kings of Wessex, or West Saxons. That's a Wessex. The most notable of these rulers was Alfred, who ruled from 871 to 899. Eventually, Alfred's descendants reconquered East England from the Danes. During this entire period, there's almost no trace of Jewish life in England. It would seem that the instability of the country made it an unattractive home for Jews. The Viking raids were not restricted to England. France was also the victim of such raids. In the year 911, the raids in France came to an end as King Charles the Simple, the King of France, made a treaty with the Viking chief Rollo. The treaty gave Rollo and his followers a large tract of land around the northern French city of Rouen in exchange for their protection from other Viking raiders and their conversion to Christianity. The area that those Vikings and Norsemen took over became known as Normandy. Rollo's descendants continued to enlarge the original area. Eventually, the Normans assimilated, stopped speaking their native Scandinavian, and adopted the language of the French natives of the area. To cement their power, Rollo's descendants entered into marriage with the English monarchy, as Emma, the daughter of Duke Richard I of Normandy, married Ethelred, King of England, a descendant of Alfred. When Ethelred's son, King Edward, died in the year 1066 without children, his throne was claimed by his cousin, Duke William II of Normandy. Although Edward's brother-in-law, Harold of Wessex, was elected king, William, with the blessing of the Pope, raised an army, gathered a fleet, and went to war to conquer what he asserted was rightfully his. On October the 14th, 1066, at Hastings, England, William defeated Harold, who died in the battle. After overcoming further resistance from the English, William finally marched his army to London, which surrendered peacefully, and on December 25th, 1066, he was crowned King William I of England at Westminster Abbey. From that time on, Westminster Abbey became the official place of the coronation of British kings. It took some 6 years, however, until the final English resistance was broken. In the process, William virtually destroyed the Anglo-Saxon governing class. Their lands were seized and their fortresses destroyed, particularly in northern England. History knows of William I of England as William the Conqueror. Much of the subsequent political structure of England was instituted at that time by William. The land was distributed to his Norman followers, and they rebuilt the ravaged land more firmly and efficiently than had been done before. All over the country, cathedrals and monasteries were built, as well as numerous and well-situated Norman castles that kept the country secure and under a tight military grip. William restructured the church as he appointed new bishops and established a separate system of church courts. In 1085, he ordered a survey of all of England for tax purposes, in which the population, the names of the landowners, their properties, tenants, livestock, and any natural resources such as water or timber were all recorded. The record was subsequently called the Domesday or Judgment Day Book. In 1086, William cemented his total hold on the country by instituting the Oath of Salisbury, which forced his subjects to acknowledge that loyalty to the king superseded loyalty to any subordinate feudal lord within his kingdom. In other words, he had a total monarchy, absolute monarchy. It's also important to note that England and Normandy were considered at that time as one extended country. French was the language of the Norman nobility, not English, which was spoken then solely by the defeated Anglo-Saxons. Before we go further, I would like to digress for a moment. We often speak about the feudal system and the various titles of nobility associated with it. This time, I think it would be helpful to clearly delineate the various ranks of nobility to give us a better understanding of their power and the areas which they controlled. Below the rank of king came the rank of duke. The title of the wife of the duke is a duchess. The duke's area of control is called a duchy, which made up a relatively large part of the country. Normandy, for instance, was a duchy in France. The next rank is a marquess or marquis. In Old French, marc refers to land on the border. In German, you have a similar, says the Markgraf, or Margrave, which is the Graf, the nobleman who occupies the Mark, the border area. In Hebrew, this border area is called Sapor, which Rashi often translates with the old French term Mark. A border area, of course, needs to be more heavily guarded and defended from the enemy than an area deep within the country. Hence, the nobleman who controlled that area was considered of greater importance and was given greater honor. The title of the wife of the marquis is marchioness. For most Americans, probably the most famous marquess or marquis was the Marquess of Queensbury, who supported the rules of modern boxing, which were named in his honor in the year 1866. By the way, the phrase, "put up your dukes," referring to fists, owes its origins to the marquess and his rules. Evidently, those who box were not concerned with the niceties of rank and indirectly honored the Marquess of Queensbury with the illustrious title of duke. In England, the title below marquess is earl. This term means chieftain in Danish and Saxon. This is equivalent to the title of count in Europe. The title of the earl's wife, however, is countess. The area of the earl's domain was originally called by the term shire, which you mentioned before. After the Norman conquest, the shire was referred to by the French term county, because this is the area that the count controls. Sounds familiar? This is the origin of our counties. The rank below earl is viscount, which means vice count or deputy or lieutenant of the count. This term actually came into being by the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, in the latter half of the 12th century, and subsequently was incorporated by the British. The final title of peerage is baron. This originally referred to a large feudal landowner whose area did not encompass an entire county. At a later date in British history, the titles were often given by the monarch as a mere honor, rather than any indication of actual land holdings or power. Such military leaders as the Duke of Marlborough, he was the ancestor of Winston Churchill, or the Duke of Wellington, did not actually own a duchy, but were given these honorific titles by the king for outstanding service to the crown. Now we can continue on. In the year 1087, William was fatally injured in a riding accident during one of his military campaigns. He was 59 at the time. His son, William Rufus, whom history portrays as a most disagreeable and coarse fellow, succeeded his father to the throne in London and was crowned William II of England. William the Conqueror's oldest son, Robert, inherited the Duchy of Normandy and became Duke Robert II of Normandy. After reigning for 13 years, William II was shot to death in the year 1100 at the age of 44. The official story was that it was a hunting accident, although historians claim the action was done at the behest of his younger brother and successor, Henry I of England. Eventually, in the year 1106, Henry invaded Normandy and defeated his brother Robert in battle, thus reuniting Normandy and England under one ruler. Robert was imprisoned in a castle in England where he remained for the next 28 years until he died. Nice people, these Normans. Henry I's reign saw the further strengthening of royal control over the kingdom. He created the office of justiciar, or chief political and judicial leader, as part of his effort to improve the judicial system. Also, as part of that effort, he inaugurated a system whereby itinerant judges would travel throughout the country, like circuit judges, and mete out justice through the shire courts. Henry also created the office of the Royal Exchequer, the accounting division of the government's treasury. It was called Exchequer because the original accounting was done on a checker tablecloth. And from then, this became the Royal Exchequer. The detailed tax records, which the Royal Exchequer produced for Henry I and his successors, are called the Pipe Rolls. We'll make further mention of them later in this lecture. As we clearly see, the early Norman rulers put every effort in setting up a system of strong central government combined with an equitable and accessible judiciary. The nobility at the time was totally subservient to the king, who ruled them with an iron hand. Despite an abundance of land and natural resources, a hard-working populace, military strength, and an efficient tax system, there were important ingredients that were missing from early Norman England. There was virtually no middle class, and there was a scarcity of money. Complicating matters was the canon law did not allow Christians to loan money on interest. Reluctant to loan money without interest, a very risky venture, there was very little capital available for economic expansion. But the Norman kings did make up for this disadvantage by promoting the immigration of a whole group of capitalists who were not bound by church authority and who on their own provided the much-needed capital for building and expansion as well as a large portion of the royal tax income. These, of course, were the Jews. According to William of Malmesbury, one of the earliest historians of Norman England, Jews were brought over to England by William the Conqueror. It seems that the Jewish populace kept on increasing under William Rufus, who was well disposed to the Jews, and it continued under Henry I, who, it seems, issued a charter of protection to the Jews of his realm. The Jews in Norman England, as well as the other parts of Europe, were considered a distinct community, apart from the other segments of feudal society, and were totally under the control and the protection of the king, who in a sense owned them. They were reckoned servi camere regis, or serfs of the royal chamber, like they were the personal serfs of the king. Henry's charter guaranteed them liberty of movement throughout the country and relief from ordinary tolls. Tolls were to be paid by normal citizens, not the king's personal servants. The charter also afforded them protection under law from abuse from both the nobility and peasantry. Since they were the king's personal chattel, they were not subject to the authority of the nobility. They also had unrestricted recourse to the royal courts, were not subject to the authority of lower courts. In addition, the charter gave the Jews permission to retain land taken by them as a pledge for security. In other words, when they made the loan, and the loan was due and not paid, the Jews were allowed to keep the land that was given to them for security. All of this turned out to be a mixed blessing. On the one hand, these rights enabled the Jewish community to flourish free from interference of the Norman nobility or the Anglo-Saxon peasantry. On the other hand, as privileged chattel of the king, the Jews were the subject of fierce envy and hatred as the land barons and the burghers of the city struggled to achieve independence from the monarchy. These feelings towards the Jews, based on political considerations, only intensified the hatred that the Christians already had for the Jews because of religious doctrine. After all, the Jews were the condemned murderers of their Savior, and they also denied his divinity. The Christians, in general, also held the Jews in contempt simply for being usurers, which was considered a crime under canon law for Christians. These feelings only became aggravated in the event that they personally became forced by circumstances to make use of these usurers, the Jews, and were forced to pay them high interest on their loans, or worse, if they did not make their payments in time, were forced to give up their property as a payment of their loans. Now let's read together the first section of our notes on page 1. This is titled Survae Camerae Regis, Serfs of the Royal Chamber. And we first quote from Yitzhak Arama, one of the great Spanish rabbinic authorities in the 15th century, describing the condition of being the royal serfs. Divine providence, he writes, dealt with us in a fine manner so that we shouldn't be considered mere merchandise to be sold amongst our enemies as eternal slaves, such as the Ethiopians and other pagans. Rather, we remained in the domain of the kings of the earth, and we became the serfs of the king, not serfs unto serfs, as it was in Egypt. This was the way it was throughout the whole period of our Golus. The Jews had all the lands of diaspora were the treasures of kings and noblemen, the rulers of the land. Blessed be God who put such a thought in their heart. In other words, it could be a lot worse. It's interesting that in paragraph B, we quote from the Charter of Privileges to the Jews, which were issued in the reign of King Henry II. And it seems it was based upon an earlier document of King Henry I. It should be known that all Jews, wheresoever in the realm they be, ought to be under the guard and protection of the king's liege. Nor ought any of them place himself under any rich man or lord without the king's license, because the Jews themselves and all which is there belong to the king. And if any detain them or their money, let the king, if he will and can, ask it back as if it were his own. And there's what the Jews owned, the king owned. We have to really state that the English were very progressive. It took at least another 100 years for this idea to develop in Germany. Interestingly also is a quote from the delegation of the Jews to the English king, how they describe themselves in asking for favors to the king. We quote here in paragraph C, "We are thy Jews. We are thy tributaries year by year. We are necessary to thee continually, since we are always faithful to thee and highly useful to thy realm." I was referring to their taxes. "Thou rulest us leniently and gently." I guess that was said for advertising. And finally, on the page, we have a comment by William of Newburgh, who was a contemporary chronicler of the period, of the 12th century. And he, not being part of the king's entourage, did not share the same sentiments that the king held of the Jews. By an absurd arrangement, they are happy and renowned far more than Christians, referring to the Jews, and swelling very impudently against our Savior through their great fortune, did much injury to the Christians. So we have a sense of the feelings of the populace to the Jews. They couldn't be touched, at least when the kings were truly, you know, in power. But there was no great love between the populace at large and the Jews. The first actual documented financial activity of the Jews was recorded in the earliest extant document of the royal exchequer, the pipe roll, of the 31st year of Henry I in 1130. This document indicates the Jewish community of that time was centered in London. It was led by Rabbi Yosef, referred to in the letters as Rubi Gotschke, or Yotschke, this is like Yosef, the G, the it was pronounced a G, was really a Y. Historians contend that he may have well been the Rabbi Yosef of Moriel. We know the distinguished host of Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra visited London in the year 1158. We know he stayed by Rabbi Yosef, and it could very well be the same person. Besides being a religious leader, he seems from the record to have been a capable financier. Three or four other prominent London businessmen are also mentioned in the document. Their transactions were conducted on a large scale. This seems to have mainly been with the nobility. One of them even had financial dealings with the abbot of Westminster. The pipe roll also records loans made directly to the crown by Rubi Gotschke, and that is by Rabbi Yosef and his associates, although they were of relatively small amounts. The records also show a disturbing aspect of the then current financial picture. Noblemen would not infrequently promise money to the crown, provided the crown would successfully exert pressure upon the Jews to remit their debts. Jews, on the other hand, would at the same time send gifts to the crown to exert pressure on the nobility to pay their debts. In both ways, the crown won, but the Jews were not in an enviable position. Henry I left no male heirs. His only daughter, Matilda, was named by Henry to be his official heir. Matilda's difficult personality and her unpopular marriage in 1128 to the belligerent Geoffrey Plantagenet, King of Anjou, an area in France directly south of Normandy, alienated the populace. On Henry I's death in 1135, Matilda's cousin, Stephen, was proclaimed king by the barons. Those the barons did not want Matilda to be their ruler. 3 years later, in 1138, Matilda raised an army and went to war to claim her inheritance. For 6 months in 1141, she held the upper hand in the conflict as Stephen was imprisoned by her forces. She, however, was never officially crowned, and Stephen was soon released. In the midst of her struggle, Matilda's husband, Geoffrey Plantagenet, wrested control of Normandy from King Stephen in the year 1144. After Geoffrey's death in 1147, Matilda finally gave up her struggle and she left England in the year 1148, spending her remaining years in Normandy. For a Norman, Stephen was quite weak, and during his entire reign there was widespread anarchy and lawlessness. The picture for the Jews during his reign was mixed. On the one hand, even though Christendom was in the midst of the Second Crusade in the years 1146 and 1147, King Stephen did not let anti-Jewish sentiment spread throughout his kingdom. So let us briefly look at section 2. It's on page 2. First, we quote a fascinating story that in the month of Elul, this is it's tangentially related. At the time when Radulf, this is a subject we discussed before, the priest, may God hound and smite him, arrived at Cologne, Shimon HaChosid, Simon the Pious of the city of Treyer, returned from England where he spent some time. Evidently from this we see there was connection between England at the time and Germany. When Simon came to Cologne, he boarded the vessel to return to Trier. As he set out from Cologne to board the ship, he counted worthless persons who had been defiled by the abominable profanation. In other words, these were Jews who had converted. They entreated him to profane himself, to become baptized, and then deny the living God. This is written also, this is a quote from Rav Ephraim of Bun, of Ban, in the Sefer Zechirah, from which we had quoted before, the previous lecture. He refused, remaining steadfast and loving and cleaving to his God. Then came persons of brazen face. Evidently, these were not the apostate Jews, but these were crusaders, who severed his head from his body by placing in a wine press, then cast away his pure corpse. After receiving a bribe, the burghers returned the corpse, and the righteous man was brought to Jewish burial. And again, you have a sense of the anti-Jewish sentiment. May Israel rest in goodness, and his seed inherit the earth. And finally, in the section, again, we quote from the Sefer Zechirah of Ephraim of Bun. In England, the Most High King rescued them through the instrument, as Hashem rescued them, of the King of England, Stephen, putting in his heart to protect them and save their lives and property. Blessed be he who aids Israel. In other words, even though the Jews suffered in the Second Crusade in Germany, they did not suffer in England. So this is really to Stephen's credit. On the other hand, the crown seemed to view the Jews as an almost endless source of income, whose monies were always at their disposal. For instance, when Matilda occupied the city of Oxford in 1141, she imposed a special levy upon the Jews. When Oxford was recaptured by the forces of King Stephen, he demanded from them, as a punishment for their support of Matilda, as if they had much choice, 3.5 times as much as they paid her. Since these Jewish victims were reluctant to pay such a terrible, unreasonable fine, Stephen sent soldiers with torches with instructions to burn down the houses of those who refused to pay. Only after the house of the communal leader, Aaron, the son of Isaac, was burned to the ground did the Jews provide Stephen with the funding that he demanded. In addition, throughout the period of the Jews' stay in England, they were subject to all kinds of spurious accusations, which not infrequently turned into a convenient new source of income to the crown. For instance, in the year 1130, still in the reign of Henry I, the Jews of London were accused of killing a sick man. Historians speculate that probably was someone who went for medical treatment to a Jewish doctor. He died anyway, medical treatment being as it was. The London community, with Ruby Gotchkin, in other words, Ruby Yosef, as head, was fined with the enormous sum of £2,000, probably the equivalent of over £2 million sterling today. It was today, it's $1.80. Is 1 pound, so $1.80, so it's like $3.5 million. I mean, these are just few Jews in one city. The whole royal income at that time was only some £20,000, so it's a tenth of the entire tax base. So this fine consisted. Imagine what would be if the Jews in this country, some Jews, were fined, what would be the a tenth of the total intake of the Internal Revenue Service. The Jews didn't have to pay this all of their pockets, however. A major portion of this fine was the canceling of the debt that the crown owed to the Jews for previous loans. Only the remainder was now owed to the crown by the Jews. It seems that these accusations were a convenient and not infrequent method for the royal government to avoid payment of their loans to the Jews. Just to give you some familiarity with the old British monetary system, I'd like to explain the various denominations. The monetary unit of Great Britain is the pound sterling, which originally was equal in weight to 1 pound of silver, and was divided into 20 shillings of 12 pence, or pennies each. The penny was further divided into 4 farthings, like a fourth. That's why I don't give a farthing. It means it's the smallest coin. And it would seem that those days a pound of silver had a tremendous buying power. I mean, today it's like an ounce of silver is only some $5. But then a pound of silver was tremendous buying power. In the year 1144, an event occurred in England that set yet a new pattern for libelous charges against the Jewish community. On Easter Eve of that year, the dead body of a young skinner's apprentice named William was found in a wood near Norwich, England. Rumor had it that he was a victim of the Jews, who had enticed him away from his family and crucified him after synagogue services on the second day of Passover. This was the first recorded instance of the outrageous ritual murder accusation. A wave of religious exultation swept through the city of Norwich. The child's body was buried with great solemnity in the cathedral, where miracles were said to be wrought at the gravesite. In fact, down to the time of the Reformation, the relics of William of Norwich were venerated as that of a saint and martyr. Fortunately, the sheriff of Norwich, as the Shire Reeve, permitted the Jews to take refuge in the castle, and he would not allow the Jews to be taken to trial at the bishop's court. Unfortunately, one of the Jewish community leaders of Norwich ventured into the open was killed by followers of a knight who was in his debt. Stephen died in the year 1154 and was succeeded by Matilda's son Henry, who was crowned in Westminster Abbey as Henry II. Geoffrey, the Count of Anjou, Henry II's father, was known as Geoffrey Plantagenet, which refers to the sprig of the broom plant, or Plantagenista, that Geoffrey wore in his hat. I mean, there's a picture of Henry also wearing this. It was for that reason that the entire family of Angevin kings, or kings descended of Geoffrey of Anjou, are referred to by historians and by William Shakespeare by their surname, Plantagenet. The dynasty that Henry II went on to found continued through the male line for over 300 years until the reign of Henry Tudor, or Henry VII, who seized the throne in the year 1485. Although his father was not of royal blood, Henry Tudor's mother, Margaret Beaufort, was a direct descendant of Henry II. By the way, Henry Tudor's son was the famous Henry VIII. Whose daughter was Queen Elizabeth I. Even before Henry II took the throne of England in 1154, he had already ruled a vast area in France. He had inherited the Duchy of Normandy in 1150, Anjou in 1151, and he also acquired the Duchy of Aquitaine, a large area in southwestern France, through his marriage of Eleanor of Aquitaine in the year 1152. Many historians view Henry II as perhaps the greatest king of England. At the height of his reign, he ruled over an empire that stretched from Scotland to the Pyrenees, which made him the most commanding figure in Europe. Historians describe him as a man of high intelligence, practical wisdom, and physical vigor. After the rule of Stephen, when anarchy reigned, and the barons wrested control from the central government, Henry managed to reassert central royal control and create a strong and stable royal government. Under Henry, many governmental reforms were instituted, a new class of professional royal officials emerged, and new record-keeping practices reflected the increasing complexity of English society. From a historical perspective, Henry's greatest accomplishment was the development of the system of royal justice and hence of common law, which was to become the basis of the legal system of most English-speaking peoples, including that of our own country. Common law employed the jury, made the king's legal initiative in the form of a writ available to all free men for a modest price, and began due process under law. Probably the most famous single episode of King Henry's reign was the king's quarrel with his friend Thomas Becket, whom he had made Archbishop of Canterbury. Henry had hoped to free his kingdom's church from papal leadership and thereby subject it to his own. Becket, however, firmly opposed this policy. His murder in 1170 in Canterbury Cathedral by knights loyal to Henry caused considerable uproar and forced Henry to make peace with the papacy and make public penance at Becket's shrine at Canterbury. From a Jewish perspective, the 35 years of Henry's reign was the most prosperous, tolerant and productive of their entire stay in England, perhaps a bit too tolerant. Records show us that the Jewish financiers lent money to abbeys and ministers on the security of vessels used in Christian service and even relics of saints. They placed their wives and children in monasteries during times of disturbance. They kept business deeds in the cathedral treasuries. There were familiar figures in St. Paul's Cathedral in London where they resorted to seek their debtors. All of this, of course, is very questionable from a halachic, from a Jewish legal standpoint. In London, York, and Lincoln, the Jewish financiers aroused comment from the Gentile neighbors by the stone houses, almost fortresses, which they built for their security, at a time when the majority of the populace lived in relatively flimsy wood houses. To this day, some of these houses are still extant in Lincoln, England. This brings to mind that Savoy, the Testament of Yehuda HaChosid, which we quote here on page 2. This is paragraph 3. Section 3, where he says, "Lo yivne odem bayis shel avonim," person should not build a house of stones, rather buy. If he did build it, he should not live in it for a time, for he and his children will die. This is often from the Savo. Rather, he should sell it. A wooden house is a subject of doubt. Notice he wanted, this was a testament, a will and testament to his children, that he wanted to live simply. And there's a question why this is so. The Chasam Sofer, in a tshuva, in a responsum, speculates that perhaps it's the idea that we should not forget that we're still in Golus, we're still in diaspora, our real home is Eretz Yisrael. Although we're forced to be outside of Eretz Yisrael, we shouldn't get too comfortable. But perhaps there's this another reason here in terms of inciting the envy of the non-Jewish populace. Again, I don't know what the step below wooden is, but evidently he wanted them to be in the most simple of dwellings. The Jews were not only valuable taxpayers, but also lent considerable monies to the crown, and this is in King Henry II's reign, often together in consortiums, to defray the day-to-day expenses of running the government. In other words, they would loan. They would put money forth, and it's somewhat like the government here in the U.S. does today with issuing, you know, treasury notes. These loans were secured with drafts for the tax revenue that would be collected at the county level. So when it would be collected at the county level, then the Jews would collect their debts. The wealthiest Jewish financier of that day was Aaron of Lincoln. Records show that he secured loans to private individuals and noblemen with their grain, armor, estates, and houses, eventually acquiring important interests in 25 counties, especially in South and Southeast England. He maintained agents in at least 17 counties. Loans were contracted with him to build no less than 9 Cistercian abbeys, as well as the cathedrals of Lincoln and Peterborough. When he died in 1186, in terms of liquid assets, according to historians, he was probably the wealthiest man in all of England. Like a good Norman, the king exercised his full monarchical rights and declared all of Erin's property be given to the crown. The bullion and treasures he collected was sent to France to assist in the war he was waging against Philip Augustus, the King of France. This time, though, Henry did not enjoy the fruits of his robbery. The ship carrying this treasure was lost at sea as it was crossing the English Channel. The outstanding debts owed personally to Arran came to 15,000 pounds sterling, three-quarters of the entire royal income for a single year. Including in the list of those who owed him money were the King of Scotland, the Count of Brittany, the Archbishop of Canterbury, many earls, bishops, and cities. The king set up a special department with two treasurers and two clerks to collect these debts. In general, regular taxes from Jews in Henry's reign came to some 3,000 pounds a year, over a seventh of the entire royal income. I mean, there were very few Jews in England at the time. I mean, in relative terms. This did not take into account special taxes. For instance, when the king was planning to raise an army for the Third Crusade against Saladin, he assessed the entire English people a tithe, 10% of their property, to be paid to the exchequer. The Jews were assessed one quarter of their property. It is significant that the king expected to bring in from the Jews alone, this is what the records say, some 60,000 pounds against 70,000 pounds from the general levy. If the king's estimates were correct, the Jews at that time were enormously wealthy. It was also, it was in the king's best interest that they remain wealthy in order that they continue to be a major source of royal income. At least during Henry's reign, even when he overextended himself in the taxes, the Jews still were quite well-to-do. In the middle of Henry II's reign, we find official records of Jewish communities throughout all of England: London, Norwich, Lincoln, Winchester, Cambridge, Thetford, Northampton, Bungay, Oxford, Gloucester. The Jewish population was supplanted with new immigrants after 1181 as King Philip Augustus expelled the Jews from his domain, Ile-de-France, Paris and its environs. Jews also came from Germany, Spain, and even Russia. As a result, the records at the end of King Henry's reign show an expanded Jewish presence in many other additional communities. Up until the middle of Henry II's reign, there was only one Beisach Forus, one burial ground for all of the Jews of England. It was situated near London. With the increasing Jewish population, the situation became unbearable. So in the year 1177, each Jewish community was officially permitted to purchase a place outside of their respective city walls to bury their dead. With material prosperity and population growth, we also find England to become an intellectual center as prominent scholars made England their home. In the year 1158, we find Rav Avraham ibn Ezra in London, in the home of Rav Yosef Morel, quite possibly, as we stated before, the Rubi Yatschka, mentioned in the Pipe Rolls. Here he composed his religious philosophical work, Yesod Mora, as well as his work, Higeres HaShabbos, where he proves that the definition of the Jewish day from the time of the original creation till the present has always been from sundown to sundown. This is contrasts the opinion that we quoted in a previous lecture of Rashbam, Shmuel ben Meir, who maintained that originally the day began from sunrise to sunrise. And we quote here on page 2 in section 4, in his preface to Yesod Mora, he said, I, Avraham the Sephardi, Spain was called Ibn Ezra, began to compose this work, Yesod Mora, to write in the city of London, England, in the month of Tammuz. There's a month of Av at the end of 4 weeks. This is in the year 4918. It was 1158. We also find the Balei Tosfos, Rabbi Yom Tov of Yoani, Rabbi Yaakov of Orleans, who in all probability moved to England sometimes after the expulsion of the Jews from Ile-de-France. Of them we shall soon speak at length. In conclusion, the reign of Henry II marked the zenith of Jewish life in England. The Jews grew prosperous, contributed to the growth of England, at the same time maintaining a high profile, very friendly relations with Christians, even entering their places of worship and taking their religious articles as security. Amidst of all of this relative success and good relations between Christians and Jews, there were signs of stress. First of all, throughout Henry's reign, there were repeated accusations of ritual murder. In 1168 in Gloucester, in 1181 in Bury St. Edmunds, and 1183 in Bristol. In addition, anti-Jewish legislation had already been promulgated by Pope Alexander III in the Third Lateran Council in the year 1179, and England was very loyal to the Pope. Also, at the end of Henry's reign, England was preparing for the Third Crusade, and the crusading spirit itself, has been noted, was subtly and sometimes not so subtly anti-Jewish. All of these various factors led to the tragedy that occurred after the death of Henry II in 1189. Henry's successor was Richard the Lionheart, one of England's most renowned kings. On the afternoon of Richard's coronation, on Sunday, September the 3rd, 1189, as the festivities were at its height, a delegation representing the Jewish communities of the realm presented itself at the gateway of Westminster Abbey. Some of them, eager to see the magnificence, took advantage of a momentary disorder and slipped in uninvited. They were driven out by a zealous doorkeeper with terrible brutality. This in turn instigated the crowd of Gentiles who were at the palace gates. And again, it's just from a halachic question, it's just very doubtful even walking in to Westminster Abbey. They beat or trampled some of the deputation to death. One wealthy fellow, Benedict of York, saved his life by consenting to be baptized. Exaggerated rumors of the event at Westminster spread throughout the city, where it was reported that the king had ordered all the Jews to be exterminated. This was the rumors. In their well-built stone houses, the Jews were able to resist the onslaught of the rioters for some hours, until one of the mob threw a lighted torch on top of the thatched roof. The homes were stone, but the roofs were not stone, which burst into flames and spread throughout the Jewish section. Although some of the residents found refuge in the Tower of London or under the protection of friendly Gentile neighbors, several others perished in their homes or were killed when they ventured out into the streets. All told, 30 Jews lost their lives, including one of the Gedolei Ador, the preeminent biblical and Talmudic scholar, the Baal Tosfos, Rabbi Yaakov of Orleans. When Richard finally was made aware of disorders, he decided only to prosecute a few of the ringleaders. 3 were hanged, 1 for robbing a Christian, and 2 because the fire that they kindled burned down a Christian house. Little else was done except for dispatching letters to all parts of the realm, ordering them to leave the Jews in peace. By the way, Benedict of York, who only converted to escape death, was allowed to resume the practice of Judaism by the Archbishop of Canterbury. Before we go on, it would only be fitting to touch upon just like the life of the martyred Rav Yaakov of Orleans. We're on page 3. Here we find, you could look yourself here on page 3 from the Seder Hadoros, it would be the Jewish version of these events. We find Rav Yaakov of Orleans quoted extensively in the Tosfos. We quote just from one here, paragraph B, in Tosfos Yevamos in 4a. What's interesting, which affects us to this very day, is a ruling of Yaakov of Orleans, which is quoted here in paragraph C of page 3. You asked regarding a non-Jewish woman. This is from a response of Mayor of Rothenburg, of having a non-Jewish woman heat the oven in the winter on Shabbos. In France, in the house of my master, the custom was to allow it. He said that Rabbi Yaakov of Orleans had permitted it. This was based upon the reason that a non-Jew is allowed to fix the fire of even someone who is sick with a non-life-threatening ailment. Since everyone is considered to be vulnerable to sickness because of the cold, it is allowed. And this is really a principle which is used in halacha. used in Jewish law. Rav Yaakov of Orleans also authored a commentary to the Torah, which we find in a comprehensive commentary which is published today. I mean, the commentary of the Balei Tosfos. He is often quoted in the commentary of the Rivo. This Rivo is Rav Yitzchak ben Eliezer, and of which we could see in your notes. As long as Richard was in England, his proclamation to protect the Jews was honored. However, in December of 1189, Richard traveled to France in order to raise a sufficient army for the Crusades. Meanwhile, in every English town, crusading detachments were being assembled for departure overseas. As you mentioned before, the crusading spirit was very anti-Jewish. That, combined with a general jealousy of the Jewish wealth, which was accumulated through usury, was an explosive mix. The first outbreak occurred in the beginning of February in 1190 in the port city of Lynn in Norfolk, when a recent convert from Judaism, a Meshumad, took refuge from the insults heaped upon him by his former co-religionists and ran into a church. The Jews had the poor judgment of going after him into the church, again, which was not allowed, according to Allah. Consequently, the caretakers of the church called for help. Rioting ensued, in which foreign sailors took a major part. The Jewish community was all but exterminated. The houses were stormed and pillaged. The inhabitants were killed or burned in the flames, which destroyed the Jewish section and a good part of the city. A few days later, the news reached Norwich, where the example was followed. Fortunately, the Jews, for the most part, took refuge in the royal castle. On March 7th, the riots moved on to Stamford. Although most of the Jews sought refuge in the royal castle, again their houses were pillaged and their property seized. The riots spread at that time to many cities in England, including Lincoln. The worst tragedy, however, occurred in the old established Jewish community of York in the north of England. The local barons were heavily indebted to the Jews there. Upon hearing the news of the riots in southern England, they decided to seize the opportunity to wipe out their debts. One stormy March night, a number of conspirators broke into the house of the widow of Benedict of York. Benedict, we mentioned, had been forcibly converted in London that past September, had been released. He unfortunately died on the way back home from the wounds he received at the coronation riot. His widow and the members of her household were murdered by the York rioters, their property plundered, and the house set aflame. The next morning, the majority of Jews went to the warden of York to seek refuge along with their more precious belongings in the royal castle. It seems from contemporary accounts that the Jews, fearing treachery, did not even let the warden into the tower which they were staying. The warden then asked for help from the sheriff because he wanted to go in. And the Jews were not, at least according to the non-Jewish account. The warden asked help for the sheriff, who summoned the armed forces to take back the castle tower. We're going to see a slightly, this is taken from the royal account. We'll see just a slight different version here from the Jewish account. That evening was Erev Shabbos HaGodol, the eve of the Shabbos that precedes Passover. Rabbeinu Yom Tov of Yohani, one of the Balei Tosfos and the leader of York Jewry, told them all to prepare themselves to sanctify God's name. Fire was set to their valuables and the building started going up in flames. Just like the victims of the First Crusade, the Jews proceeded to kill themselves and their families. Rabbi Yom Tov was the last to die. The next morning, as the attackers were preparing their final assault, they persuaded the few survivors to throw open the gates if they would agree to embrace Christianity. As they ventured out of the stronghold, they were all massacred. The ringleaders of the riot immediately made their way to the cathedral and demanded of the sacristan, the guardian of the holy vessels of the church, to give up the bonds which the Jews had deposited with them, as the Jews wanted to make sure it was in a safe place. These they burned, kindling them with a light on the high altar of the church. Shortly afterwards, most of those responsible for the riots left for the crusade. Like mitzvah gereres mitzvah, as one mitzvah leads to another. The few Jewish survivors from the city of York who had hidden with neighbors in the city and not fled to the castle were removed to London. It was many years before another Jewish community was established in York at the end of this medieval period. I mean, subsequently, Jews did not return to York, but in that period. Jewish sources have preserved the details of the tragedy of York in great detail, and here on page 4, or just before we go on, just to highlight this. First, we quote from Ephraim of Bun. Afterwards, in the year 4950, the errant ones came upon the people of the Lord in the city of York, England, on the great Sabbath, Shabbos HaGodol, and the season of the miracle was changed to disaster and punishment. All fled to the house of prayer. Here Rabbi Yom Tov stood and slaughtered 60 souls, others also slaughtered. Some there were commanded they should slaughter their only sons, whose foot could not tread upon the ground from their delicacy and tender breeding. Some, moreover, were burned for the unity of their Creator, referring to the fire. The number of those slain and burned was 150 souls, men and women, all holy bodies. Their houses, moreover, they destroyed. This is the crusade. The populace, and they despoiled their gold and silver and the splendid books which they had written in great number. Evidently, which is indicative of the level of scholarship of England at the time. Precious as gold and as much fine gold, zovim posim. There being none like them for their beauty and splendor. These they brought to Cologne, in other words, the Gentiles, and to other places where they sold them to the Jews. In other words, the gold they took from themselves. What did they do with Sforim? They wanted to make money from them too, from the books. This is how, again, this William of Newbury, which we quoted before, describes the sentiment of the populace. A certain old man, this is referring to Yom Tov Yoani, a most famous doctor of the law, who it is said had come from the parts beyond the sea to teach the English Jews. He was honored by all and was obeyed by all as if he had been one of the prophets. Rabbi Yom Tov Yoani, besides being quoted in the Tosfos, was also an author of religious poems, a piyutim. One of them we say on every year, on the night of Yom Kippur. This is this Omnom Kain, Yetzer Soichen Bonu. It is true that the evil inclination arouses us, so it is for you to justify. He was abundantly just and to answer us, Solachti, and then Solachti, I have forgiven. This was composed by Rabbeinu Yom Tov. We also, one of the kinos, one of the lamentations that are said every year on Tisha B'Av, was composed in honor of the martyrs of York. And here we just take from one of them, and again we see a slight different, the version evidently, and this is what the church, the Gentiles actually told the official courts, that they had done this just merely to gain back the castle. And not to intimidate the Jews. From an account which is written, a contemporary Jewish account we have, they were gathered into the castle together with Osher, evidently a scholar. Remember, the prince, warden, oppressed us, and adversaries stood at his right hand. We said, plunder our property, but they replied, no, we have come for Rabbeinu Yom Tov, as they wanted to either forcibly convert him, kill him. He was like Sinai, a man of great knowledge, and one who could move mountains. He was also gifted with great analytical skills. He was Oikir Horem. He made the crooked straight. Whether he taught orally or through a book, he was not counted amongst those that err. May he rest in peace. May his flesh not decay. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob. It refers also to one of the leaders of the community, Yosef, the fox's whelps. This is referring to the invaders, made a great breach, and we knew that the gates of prayer were closed when Joseph was gathered up Joseph, Yosef, a man of life. This is a man, mighty of deed, who used to send the barefoot new shod on the road, as he was a wealthy philanthropist. The righteous moaned after God. All who hear the report are astounded. Then Eliyahu, evidently is again one of the prestigious martyrs, called the angels and he bade them, "Tell your master, behold, Eliyahu is here." Again, referring to his death. Who is this Eliyahu? There are those who would want to say, historians, that there is a Rabbeinu Eliyahu of York, who is referred to in the Tosfos. Here, this is on page 5, paragraph F. This is Rabbeinu Eliyahu, this is Mi'av Ravika, which is referring to. That was this was a based on the Latin name for the word York. HaKadosh, the sacred, referring to the martyr. And he is quoted as asking a question. However, and some refer this as the same Eliyahu. However, we quote a similar, this is Tosas in Zvachim, Tosas in Yoma, in quoting that same question, the same person. It says, Hikshur ben Eliyahu Mevyar Gzatzal, and then he says, V'tiritz loy Rabbi. And the answer is, my Rebbe, my master, answered him. The author of the Tosfos in Yoma is Rabbeinu Meir of Wurttemberg. And it was authored at the end of the 13th century. His Rebbe, which would be, would not be clear, but either Rabbi Chiel of Paris, or Shmuel Bar Shlomo of Falaish, lived in the mid 13th century. And if they answered him, evidently he was martyred at a much later date. And he's still called for coming from the city of York. So he's either originally from the original survivors who left York, or York was subsequently repopulated. But it would seem that he is really not the same Eliyahu mentioned in the poem. When the king heard of the rioting, he is said to have been furious. First of all, the king had expressly protected the Jews by the previously quoted proclamation. Secondly, rioting by its very nature posed a serious threat to the public order and could not be tolerated. And finally, and most importantly from the standpoint of the king, the Jews were a major source of royal revenue. Any monies taken from the Jews, it was in a sense stealing from the royal exchequer. An army was sent to York to bring to justice the ringleaders of the riots. The barons responsible for the riots fled to Scotland before the army arrived. Their property, however, was temporarily confiscated. Later it was returned. Fines were imposed on 50 prominent burghers and the sheriff was removed from office. But not a single capital penalty was inflicted. In Lincoln, 80 people were arraigned, but they were eventually, this is only fined. From that time on, English Jewry experienced a steep and steady decline. If one would briefly explain the steps of that decline, was first, in order to ensure that the crown would not suffer any further attempts to destroy Jewish property, there was a new proclamation came out, and two exchequer officials were appointed for the express purpose of supervising Jewish affairs. All possessions and credits of the Jews had to be registered with the crown. Six or seven cities throughout England were to serve as an official financial Jewish center. And from then on, all deeds and contracts were to be drawn up in duplicate in the presence of royal officials. One copy was to be deposited in a chest provided with three locks and seals. And as a final precaution, every Jewish financier was to take a solemn oath holding a Sefer Torah, a Torah scroll, that he would register all of his transactions and denounce to the authorities any forgeries or evasions that would come to his notice. In other words, every debt had to be registered. And it was twofold purpose. they were sure that even if the Jew died, the debt would be collected. And second, they knew the exact income of the Jews in terms of taxation. Under Richard the First's successor, the much-hated King John, who ruled from 1199 to 1216, the situation of the Jews sharply deteriorated. Enormous fines were charged individual Jews. Certain debtors were exempted by the crown to pay back their debts to their Jewish creditors. It was done before, but now it was done on an unprecedented scale. And special tax levies were made on the Jewish community that almost drove them to destitution. In addition, because the taxes that the Jews paid propped up John's regime, and he was very much hated, there was tremendous animosity towards the Jews. The taxes kept on going higher. In other words, for instance, in the year 1207, besides the regular tax of 4,000 marks, this is an enormous sum, which evidently hit. This was an additional special levy of a tenth of the value of their bonds was made. They had to pay a tenth of their debts. In the year 1210, a special tallage after he had been defeated in Ireland, a special tallage of 66,000 marks was made. The Jews had to pay, and it kept on going further and further, and as a result. There was a major exodus in 1210 of Jews from England. They just could not pay. So even the poorest Jew was required to pay 40 shillings. And anyone who could not pay had to leave the country. The following year was the exodus where some 300 scholars, Bali Tosfos, including many English scholars, left France with Rosh Shimshon of Shantz and came to Eretz Yisrael, which is a subject of previous lecture. This is all because of King John. By the end of John's reign, the Jews were already impoverished. And time does not allow me to go through all the details, the sordid details, of all the extra taxes. The one who followed King John was his son Henry III, who kept on adding the regular taxes from the years 1227 to 1259 came out to a quarter of a million marks. It's a tremendous amount. And there were all constantly new and special taxation was made. But it's important just to share with you that besides how they were becoming impoverished, there was a new incident which made the life of the Jews even more tenuous. In the city of Lincoln, in August of 1255, the body of a boy named Hugh, who was a son of a widow named Beatrice, was found dead in a cesspool near the house of a Jew named Copan. Copan's name was Yaakov. The Jew had been missing for 3 weeks, and as historians point out, in all likelihood, he had fallen in running after a ball. The corpse was removed to the cathedral to the accompaniment of what was reported to be miraculous manifestations, which is a clear indication to believing Christians that little Hugh of Lincoln had died a martyr's death. His body was escorted by the dean of the cathedral and the other priests, together with a long procession bearing crosses, candles, and burnt incense. All of this amid chanting and weeping. The Jew Copan, near whose house it was found, was seized and tortured until he quote-unquote confessed that little Hugh had been put to death as part of a Jewish ritual. The king, who happened to be in the neighborhood, heard the news and rushed to Lincoln in order to personally be informed of the facts. He ordered Copan to be hanged after being dragged up and down the steep streets of Lincoln, tied to a horse's tail. The rest of the Jews who were implicated numbered some 100, were brought to London, followed by a quote-unquote jury of 24 burgesses, citizens of the city, and 24 knights. 18 of those accused preferred not to submit to this biased tribunal and demanded that a mixed jury of Jews and Christians be appointed instead. This was taken to be an admission of guilt, and they were immediately hanged. The property of the executed Jews were confiscated by the crown. By some odd coincidence, they happened to be amongst the richest Jews of the kingdom. The remainder, with the exception of three, were pardoned or acquitted before the case came to trial, were all convicted and sentenced. Thanks to the intervention of the king's brother, Richard of Cornwall, to whom jewelry of that kingdom had recently been mortgaged, the surviving prisoners were ultimately released after paying heavy fines. In the eyes of the populace, however, it was clear that the Jew had been the victim of the despicable Jews. This is how a contemporary chronicler, Mather Paris, described the death of Little Jew of Lincoln. About the feast of Peter and Paul, the Jews of Lincoln stole a child called Jew, being 8 years old, and when they had nourished him in the most secret chamber with mild and other childish ailments, they sent to almost all the cities of England wherein the Jews lived that in contempt and reproach of Yeshu, they should be present at their sacrifice at Lincoln. And coming together, they appointed a Lincoln Jew for the judge as if he were Pilate, Pontius Pilate, by whose judgment, by the consent of all, the child is afflicted with sundry torments. He is whipped even unto blood and lividness, crowned with thorns, with spittings and strikings. After they derided him in diverse manners, they crucified him. And they believed this. Little Hugh of Lincoln eventually became canonized as a saint, and his body was buried in a splendid shrine in the cathedral, where his relics were venerated down to the time of the Reformation, as though of a martyr working miraculous cures. The legend of Little Hugh enter the folklore was quoted by Chaucer in his Canterbury Tales, was repeated in stories and ballads long after the Jews left England. It was from stories like this that generations of Englishmen received their impression of Jews. In the midst of all of this anti-Jewish sentiment, most places throughout England demanded Jews be excluded, and it soon became illegal for any Jew to live in an area where there was no recognized Jewish community. This in turn led to an influx of Jews to already heavily populated areas, causing even more resentment amongst the general populace. Things became so bad. Eventually, Edward III's son, Henry III's son, Edward, came to the throne and forbade Jews to even lend money on interest, which really deprived them of their entire income. Those who previously, those wealthy financiers who had made previous large cash advances to merchants and farmers for grain and wool, and had many contacts in the business world, now became traders on a very large scale. So basically it was just a slight change between lending, or taking the merchandise itself and turning it over. This was the exception. But the Jews were under Edward's reign, even became their situation became much more tenuous. Finally, it was clear to Edward that the Jews were no longer of any significance to the crown and were simply a burden to protect, because there was tremendous anti-Jewish sentiment. There was virtually no tax income from them. There were previous debts that they had that were uncollected from the time that they were allowed to lend on interest, and also from their business dealings, which they sold money, they sold merchandise, and on credit. The king was in desperate need of new funding. He had made a recent commitment to ransom his cousin Charles of Salerno, the king of Sicily, So on that basis, on Tisha B'Av, on July 18th, 1290, the Jews were ordered to leave England before November 1st. The chests containing their yet uncollected debts had already been sealed by the government some 20 days before. In a relative act of kindness, public proclamation was made in every county that no person should injure, harm, damage, or grieve the Jews in the time which was to elapse until their departure. After being in that country for well over 200 years, the 16,000 Jews of England began their departure. In one tragic incident, on October 1290 at Queensborough, at the mouth of the Thames, anchor was cast at low tide, and the ship grounded on a sandbank. The captain then invited his Jewish passengers to disembark with him and stretch their legs. When the tide began to rise, the captain ran back to the ship, climbed back on deck, and told the Jews to call out to their prophet Moses to save them, as he had done in the past. The whole party of Jews, without exception, drowned, and the property left aboard was divided amongst the sailors. In this case, however, there was some justice, for when the crew returned to England, the culprits were tried and hanged. These were not the only casualties of the expulsion. Many others died in stormy seas. Most made it, however, to France. However, under pressure of the Pope, many of these immigrants were forced to leave France the next year, wandering about looking for a new country that would take them in. The Jews of England left their synagogues, cemeteries, their homes, bonds for past loans, and delivery of grain and wood and wool. These all fell into the hands of the king. In a sense, the rise and the tragic fall of English Jewry follows a similar pattern in other countries. Why was it the lot of English Jewry to undergo such suffering and indignity? We can only speculate. What stands out from the narrative above, however, is that at the height of their success, English Jewry maintained a high profile, had the best relations with the government, and the church, which had helped fund many churches, were built on Jewish money, and was not averse of entering the cathedral to conduct business, or, as we noted in the story of the coronation of Richard I, simply enjoy the beauty. This also seems to follow a similar pattern which we discussed in the previous lecture regarding Spanish Jewry. And it's perhaps because they were too good, and they began to a great extent, identify with the general populace, that this brutal backlash occurred. Remember, at that time of Henry II, they were tremendously wealthy. By the time of Henry III, 100 years later, they were desperately impoverished. At the end of the 13th century, at the twilight of the glorious period of the Bali Tosfos, Hashem sent Germany a leader who was head and shoulders above the rest of his generation. Through his commentaries, response, and personal example, he has left all of Jewry with an inspiring legacy. Through his own personal disciples, he raised a generation of learned scholars and leaders that followed in his footsteps. His name is Rav Meir ben Rav Boruch, known widely as Maram Rutenberg, the Rabbeinu Meir of Rothenburg. His story is the subject of the next lecture in 2 weeks. Now, are there any questions?
I agree with your advice, though, is that the story that would fit into this narrative at all?
It's been many years since I read Ivanhoe. He's the father of Rebecca. There is a certain background, you know, I mean, it's a Bubba Meisel, you know, Ivanhoe. It's a very entertaining work. Right. It's much more true from that historic perspective of the Jews. The Jews, I mean, really, this is the time of Richard the Lionheart. The Jews had a very prestigious place in England under his successor John I. It fell terribly.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.